Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Poetry Salon Cast. I am Tricia Faye Hefner.
And I'm Douglas Manuel.
On each episode, we interview one of our favorite poets to ask about their latest book.
What was difficult and what was easy about writing it.
And my favorite question, what do they do with a rough draft that wants to play rough?
If you want to hear more about the writers we interview and work with them in person, you can attend a live reading and workshop with them at the Poetry Salon.
Find out more and register for great workshops and events with us and our favorite poets at www.thepoetrysalon.com.
Now, without further ado, welcome to this week's episode of the Poetry Salon Cast.
That shirt makes you a whore because it's black. I paid for the whore shirt with my own money, bought it at the mall. It was buttoned down and satin to the touch. Who was this whore that had never kissed anyone, not even her mother, who would not menstruate until she was old enough to leave home, until she had tasted fat, the pleasure of its depth? Whoreness must have started at the sleepovers when we played hooker. We stripped for each other. No, whoreness started younger, at 3, at 2. At birth, in the womb, whoring with balled fists and floating in the whore sea. When the 11-year-olds played streetwalker, I was the best. What did the best mean? It meant no smile. It was shame in girl form, which was shame's first form. It meant relinquish the body. It meant do not eat in front of others, do not pee in public, bathrooms, not even school. It was the body in plain sight, but hidden, the girl's small cocked hip in the room of girls. This poem is called My Babysitter Karen B., Who Was Sent to Willard Asylum. There are only two photos of me as a child. She took them, she had no child. She had cool cigarettes and a job at the drugstore. She gave me the Crayola box with the built-in sharpener. 400 suitcases were stored in the attic of Willard Asylum for the Chronic Insane. She joined her twin brother there. She wore her black hair down. A child could admire it. She bought me an Easter basket, a stuffed rabbit whose fur rubbed off. She walked everywhere. She painted circles of blush on her cheeks. Loony, people said so. I mean, grown-ups who saw signs, who passed her on our street, before she started to call and say, remember. On the phone, she said, remember. Remember the date we killed her brother, forgetting he'd been committed. I took her hand and tagged along like an animal. She was perfect to a child. In 1995, when the asylum closed, an artist took photos of the 400 suitcases. The photos were put online, the contents laid out respectfully. In the open suitcases, belts, pocket knives, Lone Ranger cards, keys, ribbons, shoe polish, mirrors, pills, a fountain pen, bottle of glycerin, a zither, kit of needles, bread ration card, the Gospel of John, a letter. Each suitcase had a name, Lena C., Lillian L., Mary T., Gloria P., Cassie M., Francis T., Marion R., Catherine S., Dimitri Z., Ruby C., Anthony C., FJL, Viola G., Alice T., Carrie L., Karen B., remember.
The poems you have been hearing are from Jessica Cuello's book, Liar, out from Barrow Street Press. Jessica, welcome to the podcast. Welcome to the Poetry Salon Cast. It is really, truly a pleasure to have you here. And I like to introduce poets by how I know them. And I think The way that I know you is something that could only happen in this modern age, which is we're friends on Facebook. And I think when I saw that you had your book Liar out from Barrow Street, I saw the cover of it. I think I had maybe read one or two poems. And I just said, I am so lucky I get to know this person on Facebook, and reached out to you and invited you to the Salon Cast. And then I got your book and I read it a couple of months ago. And it's just really stuck with me, and reviewed it a little bit last night. But these poems are just so intense. And I'm really excited to get to have you here. So welcome.
Thank you for having me, for reaching out, for the Facebook friendship.
Absolutely. Thank you for accepting the friend request. You know, it's really, it's such a special time where people can be so accessible to poets that I think are, you know, quite... not only poets who are already well established, we can access their friendship on Facebook and Instagram and stuff, but also we can be friends with each other. And then when one person kind of rocket ships up, we're already pals. You know, I think that's kind of this wonderful, amazing way that the world is connected and making big poetry a little bit more small town place where we all still know each other. It's very exciting to do that. Yeah.
I wanted to just jump right in. I think that I've kind of known on the Poetry Salon podcast for asking the heavy questions early and quick. So yeah, I'll jump in. And so I adore this first poem you read, and the way that it reclaims the word whore, and the way the pantoon ends up being so insistent, so relentless of a form because of the repetition, and especially landing on that word. So could you talk about the kind of the choice to use a form of repetition with a word that has such a punch and means so much for your coming of age process, it seems, or at least the speaker's coming of age process in that poem?
Wow, that's interesting that it's you interpret it as coming of age. I like that. It's funny because the poem has kind of an absence of coming of age. It's a poem that where the protagonist doesn't have the typical markers for becoming a woman. And the disparaging part of being a woman is applied to the child, which I think is something that happens to women as girls. You begin very young to be critiqued for things that you haven't encountered, or you've encountered but you don't understand. This one was actually not a pantoum, but you're right, it has a lot of repetition. I use repetition a lot, and I think it's relentless is a very good word, because I do feel something incantatory about this particular book. Spell-like, trance-like. It has a lot to do with language that's repressed and bursting out of a density where it's compressed in the self. And it's a book, it took several years to write, but it came out of a lot of silences and muteness. So I think the relentlessness of the repetition is saying, you know, the desire to say things and to say them again and to say them again and to figure out what is the story. They're more lyric poems, but they all have, many of them have a little narrative that is fragmented throughout, and there is enough detail to give it some kind of a narrative.
Yeah, I think that word relentless applies to a lot of your work. I was thinking about this last night as I was reviewing some of your poems, and then again this morning. Like, I think a lot of us tend to say things like, that poem was really beautiful. And that's not really, I mean, beauty, of course, is it can be very vague. You can say that was a beautiful poem about a flower opening or about war. So I've been trying to think of something a little more specific to give listeners an idea of what they're going to encounter when they pick up Liar. And relentless is a good word, intense, vulnerable, honest. These poems are really They're beautifully rendered, they're beautifully crafted, but they deal with some very intense subject matter. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you came to poetry and came to, you know, forming this book in general. I know it's an open-ended question. So, you know, say as much as you want or as little as you want about that.
Well, this book is my third book. And my first two books are persona. The very first book I wrote is a triptych of women from the 13th and 14th century in their voices, a cathar. So it's about exile and blood and birth. And my second book is a very weird book. It's a voice. It's a persona book about the absent feminine voices in Moby Dick. So It's the whale speak. I make the whale woman feminine and the sea and the animals. And Lyre, you know, I've been asked this a couple times. How did you think of that? Or how did you imagine that child? Or are these your students? Or is this you? And I would call Lyre a feigned persona book. It is, it's primarily autobiographical, but I wanted to keep that hidden. You know, and now I've just revealed it on the podcast. So what I did is it has a few poems that are not autobiographical, that are interspersed, so that it's not entirely clear. Because the purpose of the book is not to be a memoir. But it is about a child. So there are two poems that are about stories students told me. There's a suicide poem that is about my mother-in-law, actually, who shot herself, but she was not my mother, she was my mother-in-law. There are a couple others that are sort of blended, mixed. So it's like a persona book, but not really. And how did I come to poetry was your second part. When I was very little, I think poetry came from song. I used to memorize my children's books. I read the Bible at 7 because I thought it would be useful to me. Really wasn't that useful, but I think I put some of that language inside me. And I think there were many things I didn't talk about. And I think poetry is such a good art form for those experiences.
I really want to ask that question about the Bible. You say at 7, you read it because you thought it was going to be useful. Do you remember in what way you thought it was going to be useful? And also the whole Bible, even all the things like just the rules about shellfish.
Yes. I mean, the hardest parts for me to get through were just the naming. Just the begatting, you know, the list of names. I had a weird discipline as a child, which I guess came from a kind of, you know, loneliness. And I would give myself tasks and lists of things to do. And so I would read things that I thought were important to read. Like I would hear people talking about this book, and this book was really special to people. So I'm like, well, I need to read this book because this book is special to people. And you know, I kind of just plowed through it, the Old Testament.
I think that's the kind of book you should get on audiobook and like listen to it while you're scrubbing the cabinets. And Joseph begat Ezemiah, and Ezemiah begat, and then they all went out and didn't eat shellfish.
This sounds so nerdy and not true, but I think you have to, you know, in the 70s, first of all, the economy was so bad. And I think people don't know that. Like everyone I knew either didn't have a car or the car had rust all over it. And people just didn't have things. And I remember how books were so deeply important to me as a means of really just soothing loneliness and and time. You know, there's, we didn't have a TV. There weren't video games. There was no computer. And so I would read, and I would go to the library for books. The librarian yelled at me once because she told me I was not supposed to return books the same day, that I had to at least keep them overnight. And she sent me home with my stack of books, which I would put on my banana seat bike. I had this banana seat bike, and I would, you know, drive it around my town. I remember feeling this craving to read, and like, if I couldn't find a book, feeling this like just terrible feeling because books were so soothing. And one time I just grabbed a book off my mom's shelf, and it was Camus, The Stranger. And I was way too young to read that. And I'd never read anything like, everything I had read was had a happy ending. Cause the Bible is like, okay, it's dark and it's violent and it's boring in parts, but it doesn't have this nihilism or this. What the fuck? And I remember I read it and I'm like, what is this? How is this a book? I'd never read a book that started off bleakly and ended bleakly.
Is The Stranger, it's been a while since I've dusted off my greatest works of Camus. Is The Stranger the one that starts out with Mama died yesterday, or was it the day before? I can't remember. That is The Stranger. Yeah. Yes.
Mama, great. That's how it starts.
Great opening line. Doug, I really, it's such a shame that people can't see your facial expressions, but from your facial expression, you're familiar with The Stranger too, right?
I might have read it a little bit too early too, and might be in love with the quote that that if one when the speaker is in prison, to say that if one has lived one day, one has enough memories to sate them for the rest of their lives. That quote all really, really, really stuck with me. But no, Jessica, our lives rhyme in so many ways that are very intriguing to me. Being the 80s baby, one of my biggest kind of, and my brother's Generation X, and I looked up to him so, so hardcore. But being an 80s baby, I'm always trying to let people know how dire the political situation was and socioeconomic system situation was at that time. So I really feel you about shining light on how dire it also was in the 70s. But another thing that our lives rhyme with is that my wife teaches women and gender studies. So like when you read that first poem, when you said shame is a girl's first form or something to that, like, I'm sorry if I'm misquoting, but that just again, that shame being such an identity marker for people who identify as female and having it happen so early on. And I can even hear kind of that meditation on shame, even in the poem about Candy the babysitter, and how that ends up being kind of almost elegy for Candy, for her sibling, and for the young occupants of the home with all those suitcases. Really just got me wondering, you know, and hearing about your other projects, what makes you want to sing these songs and tell these songs? Whenever I start a poem, I realize that there are voices that need sung that are either coming from me or coming from somewhere else. And I try to respect them and bring them to the world. And it feels like that reclaiming a subjective female experience seems important in these poems, and also one that can reach out above and beyond that. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you come to this subject matter, because it is intense, it is hardcore, but it is of witness. And I think there's, whenever there's witness, there's room for catharsis, just like with the Bible.
Yes, I like this question. I feel like this question is a lot about what the book came from. The babysitter poem came from a prompt. There was a woman, Karen, her name was Karen, and she was my babysitter before she did get taken away to Willard Asylum in upstate New York. But before she did, she was very loving to me. And I remember she gave me, this was probably an early kids movement thing, she gave me this button that said kids are people too, which my mom did not like this button, you know. It was And she was an interesting, very loving person. And then she was suddenly absent and gone. And I knew what had happened because people had mentioned it. But I think there was so much about experiences that were unsaid that people didn't talk about. And I try to explain this to my students. It's so easy to shock my students. Because sometimes I teach them to be a little more forgiving of the older generation that we're trying to catch up to them. And, you know, they're very critical. And I'll say, look, you know, when we were in high school, our physics teacher would snap our bras and their mouths will drop. And they're like, oh my God, what did you do? And this is the part that they don't understand. I'm like, you did nothing. You did nothing. You didn't, there was nothing you could do. You would get in trouble for noticing, you would get in trouble for complaining, you would get in trouble for acknowledging. Things weren't meant to be, everything was surrounded by a silence. And I think what got enshrouded in silence was the love that I had for this woman, actually. More than her, whatever happened to her, I don't know what happened to her, but I had a prompt where a friend of mine sent me this prompt about writing about a marginalized person, which sounds like it could be a problematic prompt. And I said, well, I'm going to write about Karen. And I didn't, it started off as a very short poem and then I just put it away. But then I started thinking about her again and I started doing the Google search and I was curious. So I started looking up this asylum, which isn't too far from my house. And I saw that it had shut. And I was sort of curious if they kept names, but what I ended up finding was this artist, really almost in an ekphrastic poem, because it, and why I say it was hard to write, it came from this memory of the person, but then it became about this art exhibit, which the artist put online, all of the suitcases that he recovered from the asylum, and he put their names with the suitcase and he put all of the belongings with the suitcases. It's really poignant. It's the Willard Asylum suitcases. It's beautiful, beautifully moving. Mm-hmm. I had started off seeking out Karen, but then I ended up being deeply moved by the suitcases. And of course I didn't find her name. I didn't find a suitcase for her. And then the poem became both. And I think it's where I took it from, the very intimate tribute to her, but then it became, and taking something that's small and intimate from a memory and then enlarging it to something deeper than that, farther reaching, and it became an elegy for these forgotten people.
I want to back up a little to something you'd said earlier about not all of these are persona poems about you, or they're not all autobiographical about you, but some of them are about other people, and you don't necessarily know as the reader which ones are about you or about someone else, or how the, you know, how the names have been changed, which name is being changed, which relationship is being changed. I think that's such a beautiful thing to do in a memoir. In a book of poetry, like there's a difference. You know, you're not only speaking about your own experiences, but also reaching out and saying, these were the other people who were there. These are the other people who were part of it. Or these are the other people whose stories I can voice as a poet. And I wonder if you, you know, if you want to speak a little bit about how that works in your writing. How do you choose what you want, you know, who else you want to include?
I don't know how to answer that, because I feel the who is included is calling to me. You know, they're choosing me, which sounds like a cliche. I don't think, it's not a thought process. It's still kind of a mysterious process that I you know, don't like to, I don't touch it that much. I don't have to struggle to, I think there's so much material because there is so much. I'm 50, so I didn't write about any of this. And also I've been teaching for 27 years. And it's, if we go to astrological signs, Scorpios, we just carry a lot. I have so many secrets inside me. Mm-hmm. Other people's secrets that I carry. And I think the poem sometimes comes from just needing a release from the interior. But then, the labor, the hard part, you know, when you talked about choosing the hard poem is shaping it, you know, and putting it into the form, putting it into the song. Because I didn't, you know, I was never interested in memoir. I see myself as a poet. And there are things I kept out. You know, there's a whole bunch of poems in this book that are based on misspellings from student work. And so I thought I was going to have a book of those because I had hundreds of these words that were really beautiful to me. And colleagues would bring me these words. And some of the words you had to really puzzle through. What, out of context, you know, I'd look at the word S-E-N-Y-U-R-S, seniors, you know, it'd be seniors. Or I have a whole envelope of them. And I would just, my colleague would say, what is this word? And then when you get it, it's like, you know, when you're reading a Shakespearean pun, you're like, oh yeah. You know, you get that like great delight when the word works both ways. It works visually and what the student's hearing. So I started writing a series of poems from these misspellings, and most of them just weren't good enough to publish, in my opinion. I kept them out, but many of them I kept. And what happened is when I started writing these poems from the misspellings, is they would end up having these human beings in the poem connected to the voice. And sometimes the voice was me and sometimes it was an amalgam, but it was a child. And I don't know if that answers your question, but those are put throughout.
Well, I think, first of all, I wanted to ask you that question because, and for listeners, please get the whole book, the whole collection, Liar. But one of the things I noticed just scrolling through the table of contents, there are a few titles of poems that are misspelled. One is Stomach, which I think is S-T-U-M-I-C. One is Liar, which is L-I-Y-E-R. And I did want to ask you, because there's another poem in there called, something like high school illiterate. And I was like, is she letting us into how she used to misspell things? Why are some things misspelled and some things are not misspelled? So that is fascinating. A lot of the poets we work with have worked in public education. Doug is a teacher at the college level. I've been a teacher at, from junior high to high school. So of course, we all know that there are certain things that students and even adults will misspell. So you've been collecting those and using those as the basis for some poems. That's terrific. That is such a terrific way to, you know, get creative about the way the human mind works. I did kind of want to ask, did you at any point consider the title of the book, misspelling the title of the book?
So that was the original title, was L-I-Y-E-R. And I guess I can share this.
Yeah.
The judge of the contest, Dorian Lux, wanted it changed. And when they accepted it, they suggested multiple different titles. And if Dorian Lux said, you know, take out the first 10 pages, I would have said, okay.
Yeah, you do what Dorian Lux said. Always. That's the best answer. That's the best answer. When you've penned as many awesome poems as she has.
it was hard because I did feel I liked how L-I-Y-E-R was connected to lyric. Yeah. I liked the weirdness of it, that it would be signaling you're about to enter a book that is a little strange. It's a title. So
I will just say, like, I mean, first of all, I totally agree with what Doug says. Like, if Dorian told me, take out the first 10 pages, just, yeah, of course, whatever she says, defer. But I will just say it does hit you a little harder. I think if I were to see liar misspelled, I might be distracted by the misspelling, or I might be going, is this, do I not know how to spell liar? Is it liar like Apollo makes? It would be very distracting to be thinking about the misspelling of it. Whereas seeing the book and the title liar, I'm just like, oh, liar. That's got so many great connotations. It seems deviant. It gives you a sense of what the book is going to be about and the emotional tone of it really quickly. So I can kind of understand that. I can kind of understand why that would make me a better title. Yeah.
And, you know, of course, I asked like my three most trusted poetry friends.
Mm-hmm.
And they all agreed with her. You know, one of my dearest friends, she goes, she's right. You can't name it that. And this is another friend that I just always defer to because she's mm-hmm. brilliant. I'm like, okay. And I'm wrong a lot. And I sometimes dig in. I can be very stubborn. This is one reason I wait often to submit my work, or I hold it longer, because sometimes I just can't see things. Maybe we're all like that, but something feels so certain to me, like the title has to be Elwha, because in my head, because I'm so much in my head, like so many of the speakers in the book, that it's so interior and it's so much internal. And I'm so late to understand this. I'm 51, but it took me a long time to understand that so much knowledge that I've invested in and carried and worked on learning is half as useful because it's not spoken. Mm. It's not shared. And, you know, if I had read the Bible at 7 with a friend, or a teacher or a class, it would have been a different experience. And I think a lot of the knowledge that I have is just lodged inside me, and I'm missing that communal part of it.
I think it's really cool though, because I'm seeing a theme of paying attention to what's unseen and what's unsaid. And, you know, when I think about the Melville Project as well from Moby Dick, you know, of course, like that's the other thing that's missing, right? The female voices. And, you know, as someone in the first class in our PhD program at USC, they make us take a literary theory class and all of the students have to take it. And in the way that I was taught literary theory is we had one text all semester and we did different readings from different theoretical approaches. So you do a Derridean reading, a Bakhtinian reading, a Foucaultian reading of, guess what? Moby Dick. So I also adore Moby Dick, because for one whole semester, all I did was read Moby Dick through different literary lenses. So, and one of the texts that we end up reading, and, you know, I teach at the Low Res MFA program at Spalding, is Ahab's Wife by Selena. And so I'm really interested in the way that, again, your work is always kind of shining a light on people who aren't being seen, because so often that ends up being what the female experience is in the Western world.
We'll get back to that interview in a moment. If you enjoy this podcast and want to learn more about us, log on to thepoetrysalon.com.
Most writers need a community around them to sustain their motivation and excitement for writing. The mission of the Poetry Salon is to provide inspiration, education, and support for poets everywhere at a price that is affordable.
Together, we are building a thriving community through online classes, e-courses, and readings, so you have the tools to live the life of a growing, prolific, accountable writer.
You also get opportunities to share your work and receive supportive feedback, then turn your finished pieces into journal submissions, building an audience for your writing.
Again, visit thepoetrysalon.com to find out more and register today.
And so to kind of tap back, I want to get back to something Tricia was talking to you about this kind of feigned persona. I'm somebody who my first book was unabashedly in the post-confessional vein. Like, I just leaned right into it. And then for my next book, I didn't want to even touch the lyric eye. like at all. Like I felt really almost burned by the vulnerability in which one, if you have to read your poems across the world in a country and you write from the lyric eye of how butt booty naked you feel, to use the idiomatic phrase from the Black community. And so I was wondering for you, I smelled a little suspicion or at least apprehension when you talked about writing of the self and making sure that there was that room for the know that there's the distance between speaker and writer. I was wondering, do you feel complicated things about the lyric eye? In grad school, I remember we would throw it around all the time of talking about the lyric eye doesn't exist anymore anyway. And that would usually come from a privileged body who, of course, doesn't, who has time to think about the self not mattering anymore, while minoritized bodies, of course, are like, please listen to this lyric eye because we have shit to say too, us women and us people of color. We have things to say too. So I was just wondering, again, and maybe I was mishearing, and please check me if I was, but yeah, it seemed like that that there was a little apprehension with the lyric eye. And I too have a little bit of total expression from the lyric eye, being a little suspicious of it, but I was wondering what your relationship was to it. Yeah, I hope that landed somewhere.
Yeah, no, you're not misreading. You have a good ear. I don't have the academic, I mean, the last time I did any literary theory was 1992. So
it ain't changed much. It's still a whole bunch of continental old white dudes talking shit. Don't worry about it.
I'm on social media enough. I read enough journals to see the disdain for the confessional and the lyric eye. But I think my trepidation with it is personal. It's not related to a literary movement or a time. It's literal. Like I literally distrust my own voice sometimes.
I think this is such an interesting question. I hope I didn't cut you off, Jessica. I just, it's very interesting to me because I think I've been so well-trained as a poet to know that the I doesn't mean I in the poem. And even if a poet is representing something as being purely autobiographical or very close to autobiography, we never assume that it's literal autobiography and not, you know, an emotional version or, you know, and then also we're just so skeptical of what the self is. What did I remember? You asked two people about the same event and each of them is going to have some variation on the memory. So like, you know, the idea that there is even a concrete truth that's not filtered through a subjective lens, that's just all gone out the window, you know? So I think that that's, I guess I'm lucky. And that's a thing that anyone who comes to Poetry Salon workshops and probably any institute of learning has to learn is you just never assume. You don't go up to the poet after this is over and say like, oh, I'm so sorry about your brother. Because
they always do that.
Yeah, I guess they do. But I'm very careful after a reading. Jessica, when I was reviewing your book, there were just parts of me that are going, oh my God, did this really happen to her? Did it happen to someone else? Is it exaggerated? I don't know if I should ask or, you know, and I think that's,
I know that rule, you know, never assume. And, you know, the thing I do like about that rule, one time I told someone to fuck off. I feel so bad. She was the nicest person about the fire poem that she said, did that fire happen to you? And that fire did happen to me. And she she was a fine artist, not a poet. She didn't know the poet rule. And I should have been kind to her. And you know, I think the only thing that's useful about that rule is that if you're bringing your poems to a workshop, you want to approach them artistically. Mm-hmm. But I think the silliness of that rule is that we're people.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of the workshop, I don't want to get into workshop rules because, you know, they're shifting a lot. And, I'm a high school teacher anyway, but
I want to circle back. I was really interested and passionately, and you looked into the camera. I wish that we weren't on a podcast and the viewers could see the intenseness that you did this with. And you said that you don't trust your voice. And I think that, you know, speaking from another minoritized experience, I think so often we're told not to trust our own voices. And that's why usually the people who are still writing from the confessional vein or anything close to the lyric eye come from minoritized bodies, bodies that have been marginalized, because we're the people who haven't been listened to, while the people who are talking about there is no such thing as the lyric eye and such are usually people with privileged bodies. So in the chat, really quickly, right when you said that, I said, I wondered if that's gendered, because I want to tie that back to the first poem's idea of shame being a girl's first form. So I was wondering if you could talk a little, like, do you think there's a relationship to that kind of not wanting, and again, I think this goes to your idea of all the silences and the secrets you hold as well within yourself. So I was wondering if there's something that maybe we can connect all those things with. Do you see ideas kind of connecting with that?
I mean, of course. I think sometimes I think, and this is part of the silence and the not sharing, I always feel like we all know that what you just said is true. And I always assume, and this is where I run into trouble, maybe, I always assume that that's information everyone has and everyone knows that to be true, that the marginalized people, it, like, everyone knows it. Everyone knows we're trying to put that voice down, put it away. There's not space for it. It makes people uncomfortable. It's not the dominant. And even the people saying to not write about, I had a friend, and it was Billy Collins, told her not to have so much blood about her sister's death in her poem. And to me, I always feel like everyone knows what they're doing when they say what to do or what not to do. And that's why I'm always like mystified when it becomes like a question or a topic. And I think this is the part of me that's still a child and isn't grown, is that I'm, you know, so I feel like this is how adults approach the world as doubleness. We're going to say this, but what's true is something else. And everyone knows what's true is something else. All the poets know it, but these are the rules that you have to follow, these in order to function, in order to get by, in order to not piss people off, in order. And, you know, it's like you go to a faculty meeting, you don't say X, Y, and Z. Everyone knows that. When you're in a class and you're a kid, you don't say this standardized test is bullshit. You might, but it, you know, it's not worth the price. Like, everyone understands that this is how we are raising people to function. So I'm always like confused by these questions, because I don't understand. Unless, like, people don't, because I have this discussion with my husband, and he's like, no, people don't get that. He's always like, people don't.
That's what I immediately said. You see my physical reaction. I feel like they don't, or we wouldn't have to yell so loud all the time.
Let me ask.
Okay, go ahead.
No, I just wanted to ask a clarifying question. So first of all, that explains so much. Have I supposed to be lying this whole time? That explains why I can't fit into normal society. You've just clarified that for me. Because I would be the person at the faculty meeting who would say, guys, the standardized tests are bullshit. Why are we doing that? And then everyone gives me the evil look.
Those people have trouble fitting in.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
Anyone who's neurodivergent, right? Or, you know, my husband tried teaching for 5 years and he kept running into trouble. And
yeah.
I said to him, like, you can't say that to your principal. And he goes, well, why not? Everyone thinks it. Everyone knows it. I'm like, you can't say it if you want to keep your job.
Your husband and I should start our own school. That is really interesting. Sorry, Doug, I didn't want to cut you off, but I just wanted to make sure I was understanding this. So, yeah, some people follow those rules. Some people don't follow those rules. I think that kind of sheds a little clarity on the title of the book, Liar. And
but
what
I mean,
does that mean?
I think this is a case where maybe I am wrong a lot, is that people don't know. And they don't see. It's, how do you know what people know? You know, you think,
yeah.
If we all have a gun to our head and this is our last moment on Earth, I feel like a lot of people would suddenly know things that they say they don't know. But as a teacher, I always give the benefit of the doubt because those are kids.
Yes.
And I always assume kids don't know or no one's told them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, during the pandemic, it became really clear to the kids who didn't have parents at home who were working when they came back, the things they didn't know, like how to use the lines in a notebook, that those were for the words to go in a row. So with kids, I'm so gentle. And I'm gentle with adults, but like this part of me always thinks the other person does know that they are silencing a voice and they're keeping their rules on top. Like, of course they're going to keep their rules on top.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like Baldwin said, nobody gives up power willingly, you know, nobody like, just like, you know, decides one day, I don't want to be on the top of society anymore. I'd like to be, give away some of this power that I've been using and having and wielding. I'd like to just, you know, hand it off. Nobody's done that willingly, I think, in the history of mankind, humankind, perhaps. And no. I'm also tied to this idea, you know, when we're talking kind of about the fiction of the self as well, of assuming that everybody knows, like Baldwin told us that all art is confession, either oblique or direct. And so again, like we know these things, but then we tell ourselves other lies. And that feels so poignant in the age of the rise of the 45th, and where we are right now with the way 1/6 is being made into something that it wasn't, and yet some people still know this. You know, one of the phrases that I use in my upcoming book is that, and it's very similar to what you're saying. And again, I feel so vibe with you. You're like almost exactly my brother's age, and I wanted to be him so hard. So I just want to be your little millennial little brother and hang out with you and be like, show me cool things. I wish I was of age in the 90s instead of the aughts. But yeah, no, thinking about all art being this expression of truth and like us knowing what the real is, but not saying it, just seems so what our moment is. And again, the phrase that I use in my book is that we all know what the deal is, yet we all don't know what the deal is. And that bothness, that doubling of it. So I feel like, you know, again, thinking about the way that Lyre so often reclaims these feminine spaces and these womanly voices and lets them speak and is a witness for them and like lets them stand in power. Not only do I want to give you mad props for that and how witty that is of like kind of undercutting oneself with not only the misspelling, so mixed recognition there, but then also that a liar is already somebody who's having misrecognition. Just the layers of not being seen while trying to be seen is really, really beautiful. And I think is a doubling that we've known minoritized bodies has to do and everybody has to do. That's why, you know, there's no stable self, but at the same time, so moving. So seriously, thank you for this. Thank you for that.
Thank you for being here and listening. I just write down, when I'm listening, I forget what I wanted to say, but one thing I wanted to say, to be fair to other people, is I think if we all participate in a lie or we're aware of a lie, I think maybe what people don't know is the pain they're causing sometimes. Like they know that they're keeping their rules or they're keeping their way of functioning in the world, which happens to be a convenient way for them, but they don't really know how much other people are suffering. And I always notice that surprises people when they discover it. Because I think we're born not wanting, this sounds naive, but I think we're born wanting to not make others suffer, or that we come out of the womb interested in that. That could be wrong. And then the other thing about lying, this idea of liar, I think because the book comes from this girl perspective, the child, and I think children participate in lies to survive. They participate in lies about race. They participate in lies about gender to be able to function in whatever home they're in.
Yeah.
Which is one reason why I've been less interested in the canceling and the shaming, because if I can't cancel a 12-year-old who doesn't know anything.
Yeah.
because it doesn't serve, it's not going to make things better for other people. Because kids will participate in the lies given to them by the adults that feed them and give them a warm bed because they don't have any other choice. So that is part of the liar motif in the book. And that's part of the silences, that you're participating in a lie, but internally there's something else disagreeing that you aren't allowed to speak. And I think the poems come from that impulse to speak it.
Yeah. So that's so well put. And I feel in so many ways I am very lucky because I found poetry early. I found the arts very early. And so this idea that people need to shine a light and go to literature and read the books and you'll find other people speaking the truth. Like that's something that I got very early. And you'd think maybe after how many years, like almost 100 years of the confessional poem being in vogue now, we'd all have kind of gotten that message, but it still seems so necessary. It still seems like no matter how many times we hear it, you got to keep doing it and keep doing it and keep doing it. We keep coming up with new lies, or, you know, everyone still wants to be covering up things that aren't pleasant. So we keep needing poets to go and tell the truth. And I just find that so fascinating, a little irritating. Like, when are we all going to learn our lesson?
I mean, it's beautiful. We don't know each other.
Yeah.
It takes so long to know a person. I've been married 27 years and I'm still, I found out this story last year where my husband was in a jail in South Texas. I'd never heard this story. And we are so close and we share so much. And I feel like I'm still getting to know him. And you think how hard it is to know another person. And I think poetry, someone is collecting their intimate world in a book for you.
Yeah.
They're putting it there. Sometimes, you know, I look, this is so cheesy, but sometimes I look at like my poems on my shelf, the books on my shelf, and I think about after I wrote my first book and I knew what had gone into that, I'm like, oh, that is somebody's like sweat and labor and vulnerability, like, which is why I also don't like the disparaging of poets. Like, you know, I have poems I don't like as much, or poets I don't really enjoy, or I don't reread. But everyone that's willing to share the self in an intimate way is interesting to me. So I don't know, lyric eye, not lyric eye. I don't know.
Doug, something you said that I find very, because I'm outside of academia and I don't engage in these conversations quite the same way you do. But I feel like thinking about it as from a marginalized perspective versus, you know, non-marginalized is very interesting that, and I think that's part of why poetry has gained so much momentum, especially in the spoken word community and everything, is people who haven't been traditionally allowed to speak about themselves or no one's been paying attention and, you know, they're finding more of a voice. And it's important now that they get to speak from the I. I personally like speaking from the eye because I think Mary Oliver said, like, the eye is not me. It's this gift that I'm giving the reader that I get to show them what I'm seeing and let them inhabit that eye. And for me, I just don't know. I don't know how else you would approach it without using an eye somewhere. We're getting close to the end of time. I'm so sad because this is such a great topic. Jessica, we've been talking so much about the kind of the subject matter and about truth and what stifles it. So I want to move to kind of a craft question, which is when you are writing rewriting your poems, do you have something useful that you use or something that helps you with a difficult poem? Anything you would, you know, offer as advice for poets who are still learning how to edit their own work?
Well, this particular book, because some of the material was painful, I found that the Pantoum form was helpful to contain it. and to keep it recurring and to give me a lot of control. So I used a lot of forms that had restriction and control so that I could manage what almost was like a spilling over of language, and that I had to contain it because a lot of these things had been just like churning and churning for decades. And I would find a couple poems in the book were began as one poem, and I had so much crowded in them, I had to split them out. So for this particular book, I did use a lot of forms, but then I dismantled the form once the poem showed me what it was. And then if it was too repetitive or sing-songy or the repetition was interfering with the lyric, I would reshape it and ignore the form. So I mainly used the form to get control of my material. And then I was sort of ruthless about wanting every word in line to be, well, I think beautiful. I care about beauty in my work because I want people to have pleasure when they read the poems. I do a lot of drafting and I write by hand at first.
I think that's wonderful. Just that, you know, when you've got all this pain and chaos, using a form to help control it, and what Doug put in the our chat there, form to manage the madness. Yeah, definitely. Doug, anything else you want to ask before we have to sign off?
I guess I wanted to talk a little bit about the way the liar talks to the Melville book, because I just totally see them rhyming with each other. But I think that we've gotten there. The other big thing I was trying to get at was putting pressure on the notion of the lyric I, talked about poetry of witness, talked about elegy, wanted to get there. And yeah, I really wanted to get to this can't see and unseen kind of factor that I feel like comes up in your, because I think that's a very cool dynamic of like that it's a speaker who often can't see things, but a speaker who is unseen. And that dichotomy, I think, is very, very, very cool. And again, I think that I haven't read the Melville book, but I feel as though that that would definitely rhyme with themes in that one. So yeah, I think that I've gotten to all my places. Sorry, this is a me on a cup of coffee number two. Trisha told me that I was, when I first got on, I had the baby last night and he didn't sleep very well. And so when I first got on, I wasn't my usual self, but my students and my wife say that Doug can find the Doug. So I found him. So sorry if it was a hurricane of things, but I found him. It took a couple cups of coffee, but I found him. So, go ahead.
It's just funny that, you know, the Doug is usually hiding at the bottom of the second cup of coffee. The Trisha likes to hide at the bottom of the second cup of coffee, too.
But no, honestly, I'd just like to thank you. I mean, I think that these poems, I am very interested in poems that are trying to matter. I think that there's especially a poet like you who is on book number three, it can get to poems for that feel self-serving or that feel like that there are a performance of how dope one is, especially when one has done it two other times. And so for you to still be speaking with the urgency, with the relentlessness, and still be bearing witness for other people from your, from subjective, a similar subjective experience, and for your students, and for, I would say, but I'd imagine you'd feel uncomfortable with it, I don't want to assume too much, but women writ large, is really, really powerful. It was a great read. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening and for your astute observations. Thank you for having me, Tricia.
Oh, absolutely. Jessica, just again, it's a total pleasure talking with Jessica Cuello. Her book, Liar, her third book out from Barrow Street, chosen by Dorianne Locks. Just a really terrific book. I can't say enough good things about it. Get a copy of it, read it, reread it with a highlighter, start collecting misspelled words of your own and use them to generate your own poems. Jessica, it's been such a pleasure. And when we're out in Syracuse, you'll be the first person I call for coffee. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Yeah. And Doug, we'll have to get together some other time when I'm out in LA. I got plans. As soon as I'm out in LA again, I'm going to hit you up. I'm going to come and kidnap you if I have to.
I mean, honestly, if you would have asked earlier, I would have read with you. Remember, I told you the answer is yes. And for the second book, Jessica, I'll be out your way. So I'll try to shoot you an email.
I love
Totally.
that.
you guys updated. We did not. Doug's in a different time zone than normal. I'm in a different time zone than I normally am. It could be any number of factors, how that got messed up. But I'm so glad you're here. Thank you so much for being here.
No, it's fine. I was in a training for some associate editor. So I had to, I saw your message come through. So I cut that short. And do you mind if I just grab a glass of water?
Because go get whatever you need to get yourself comfortable.
Okay.
So Doug, is this going to be our last one that we do together?
My bad.
It sounds like so, you married the right person. That's what I'm taking from this.
No, Pisces power all day. My wife and I are at three generations of Leo Pisces. And I just found out that my great, because we always end up talking Zodiac on this. So be prepared, Jessica.
Yes.
I love happens. Pisces. So, your wife is the Pisces?
Yes.
Love your wife.
Jessica, what are you?
Awesome.
Very nice.
I'm a Leo,
water
so,
signs.
You know, We got those powerful signs, that powerful energy in here today. Leo and Scorpio energy. Oh my goodness. What we gonna do?
Like two fish swimming around, a scorpion and a lion. I guess I'm the most mild here. Like I'm the least deadly of the three of us.
Oh no. Yeah. Jessica and I are extreme.
I'm going to carry a knife in my pocket. Just like I'm a fish, but I'm a fish with a knife.
Oh goodness.
So let's start this off properly with poetry and anything we do, you know, we can edit and what have you. So if at some point there's a loud noise in the background or you have to stop and cough or whatever, we'll just pause, we'll back up, and our wonderful sound design team is going to edit it out. You can see him sitting there.
I'm gonna get more coffee. Just keep on going. I'm just gonna take you guys with me. I'm walking through the in-laws house though, so if you see anybody, just, you know, it's cool.
There you go. You want to make sure Doug, you want to put it on mute just so there's no cross-contamination of noise.
Trisha, I always mute. Remember, you need to mute. Don't play me in front of company.
Welcome to our house. Welcome to the Poetry Salon Studio. Jessica, so before I give you a proper introduction, I'm just going to ask you to read two poems from Liar. And I ask that it be one that you felt was easy to read and one that was, easy to write, whatever that means to you, and one that was difficult to write, whatever that means to you. And then we'll get into the interview.
Whoa. Okay. I don't think I knew this prompt before, so give me like 30 seconds. The hard to write is, that's an easy one to determine.
So I see the baby. So while we're doing waiting, should I let the baby make an entrance while Jessica's picking up?
It's fine with me. Yeah. Jessica, if you need a second to choose poems. I'm so sorry because I thought I sent you an email with all the stuff, but things have been so crazy lately. It's very possible I just forgot to hit send.
No, I didn't get it. So I'm fine with winging it. I'm a teacher.
Right. We can all go off the fly. And the Zoom has made us even better at it. Mm-hmm. But here he is. Here's our dog, Maya. And say hi, Maya.
Hey, Maya. You're cute.
Hello. Helenito. Say hi. Say hi, guys.
Hi.
What a cutie.
See, oh my God. He's like,
you have a Christmas onesie?
Yep. we found Black Santas. We love it. We found like a whole bunch of Black Santa ones, which brought us great joy. Yeah. Huh, buddy? Say hi.
A Black
say
Santa
doing,
onesie.
Aren't they?
Like
yes,
adorable. No. God, I love onesies. Yeah. It's one of the
oh
things
no they changed want. My life. Like I don't want him to wear regular clothes ever. Like they zip up, like I never have to. No, like our baby wears pajamas everywhere, and that's the way we're gonna live our lives. Like this is where we are, huh, buddy?
They're so snuggly babies. Yes, my
babies
are 20 and 16, so
do they still wear pajamas? I mean,
yes,
everywhere.
My son has worn the same Baby Yoda pajama pants for the last 4 days.
I'm in love with him for that.
That's great.
All right, buddy.
That's great.
I'm going to worry, but you had to go be famous.
I tried to
okay?
recommend that he change for family dinner, but.
How old is he again?
He's 20.
When I was at UC Santa Cruz, I don't know, maybe it's the age or something, but like I would just show up to the dining hall in my robe and pajamas and I'd go to class in my pajamas. I think I was just testing boundaries. It's just normal. They're just testing boundaries. They're seeing what they can get away with at that age.
Oh, no, I definitely wore pajamas everywhere. We're of that age where, like, I wore sandals and a pound of hemp. I had dreads on. Like, I was so, like, you guys know how, like, you know, being an elder millennial, like, we were wannabe 70s, like, so hard, you know, in the aughts, back in the dark ages, as I tell my students, in the dark ages of the aughts. So, yeah, no, I definitely wore comfy clothes everywhere. Like, the Zoomers dress so clean and everything. They're so spiffy, even though they're wearing the baggy clothes like we used to now, which
yeah,
is kind of funny to
yeah.
me. Like, it's weird. The Zoomers look like we did in high school now. It's
is that
so
what
weird
they are now?
Old.
Are we calling them Zoomers? Is it Generation Zoom?
That's what they, well, yeah, it's because they clap back on the Boomers so hard. Like they would say, okay, Boomer all the time. So then,
okay,
like,
Boomer, okay, Zoomer. Oh, I
yeah,
love it was, that.
Yeah, because they're, yeah, oh, but yeah, no, they're hilarious, great. Bro. They make me feel old. That's all okay, I'll say. Zoomer. Like I used to think I was way cool. I used to do the cool professor pose, and these Zoomers, they don't let that slide, yo. They let you know who you really are. So I imagine your son would have a lot of smoke for me and probably would make fun of me like my students do.
Yep, kids will do that to you. They have, like, they're vicious. Anyways, okay, Jessica.
Okay, all right, yeah. We've seen a baby, and I have coffee. I'm so sorry. Let's go.
I'm just trying to get this glare off my face, but okay, whatever. I look the way that I look. Jessica, take it away. I'm going to put myself on mute, too.
Okay, so there's only actually maybe one or two poems that were easy to write because first drafts are easy, but then I labor over things a long time. And then a lot of the poems in this book that I'm reading from my book, Liar, and a lot of the poems in Liar were in forms that I then deranged. There are like 7 pantoums in the book, and then I disguised it. so they look very simple, but there's a lot of labor. But this poem came out almost whole. It's one of those gifts. And it's interesting because it's the only poem that has a little bit of humor in it, even though it's a serious poem, but it makes people laugh. And I was reading the Ekphrastic, Diane Seuss's Ekphrastic book I'm gonna get the title wrong, so I'm just gonna call it her Ekphrastic book. And the book, it's like all her books, but it was so good that I just sat down and wrote a poem after reading it. And I hardly had to change anything. So I guess I owe her this poem.
Do you want to do a random act of kindness? How about a senseless act of beauty? Please rate and review us and write a comment on this episode.
It helps us get heard, get seen, and it helps other poets find us in the chaotic distractions of cyberspace.
Are you a poet who wants to be interviewed on the Poetry Salon cast? Contact Trisha@thepoetrysalon.com and send some of your work to be considered.
And don't forget that this writer will be teaching a guest workshop on the last Sunday of this month at 2 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. To purchase tickets, write to Trisha@thepoetrysalon.com.
Thanks again for being part of our community. And whoever writes the worst draft wins!
Yay!